Golf in the Kingdom with author Michael Murphy.
This is Golf Smarter. Each week you'll get inside information on how to lower your scores through strategy and course management. We'll ask course pros, designers, and architects to reveal their secrets in an effort to improve your game. If you're a beginner or a seasoned pro, subscribe to the Golf Smarter podcast. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome and thanks for joining us for another episode of Golf Smarter podcast. You know, if you've not read Golf in the Kingdom, let me just read a couple lines about it and then we'll get right to the interview. Golf in the Kingdom is an altogether unique confluence of fiction, philosophy, myth, mysticism, enchantment, and golf instruction. Amazon.com says the story is truly unforgettable. For a golfer, Murphy's masterpiece is as essential as a set of clubs. And from the Library Journal, it says, this book offers a view of golf in a more philosophical and even mystical light. Though golf is definitely a fanatic's game, half of this is written just for laughs. Golf in the Kingdom is something that if you've not read, you may want to. And after hearing this interview, I think you're going to. Welcome, Michael.
Well, good to be with you, Fred.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. This is really a special moment for us. For the uninitiated, which if you're a golfer and you haven't read this book, I can't imagine why not, and you're going to have to, give us an overview of what Golf in the Kingdom is about.
Well, it's an Irish tall tale. It's a metaphysical comedy. It's about the mysticism of the game. It tells of one Michael Murphy, with some resemblance to the author, who is on his way to India, to an Indian ashram, in search of spiritual transformation. And he stops off at the great and fabled course of Burning Bush for a round of golf, and there meets Shivas Irons, who is a wizard, a Celtic shaman, and they play a round of golf that changes Murphy's life, and then joins a rousing dinner party in which the game is explored from various angles, and then they go out into this ravine at night looking for Shivas Irons's teacher. And then they end up in Shivas Irons' apartment where he goes into ecstatic trance. And the very things that Murphy is going to look for in India are right there in front of him, but on a golf course. And that's too much for Murphy. And so he heads on for India and turns away from the very thing for which he's looking. That's the story.
Fascinating. Okay, so there's some similarities to the Michael Murphy who wrote the book as the character.
Yes, there are. The book is filled with things that have actually happened. There is a second part to the book, a kind of afterword, a part two, which is filled with a variety of reflections. So the book, in a way, is a travel story, a mystical novel, a metaphysical comedy, and a doorway into this mystical underground of sport. And, you know, the book's been out there 34 years. It was published in 72, and it has sold more copies now than any other fiction ever written about the game of golf. You know, more than a million copies in 9 languages.
Congratulations.
And it's, inspired the formation of the Shivas Iron Society, which people can join, that has members in all 50 states and in 25 countries. So it's had this huge life, which I never anticipated when I wrote it. It's the first book I wrote, and it's the most popular of all my books. Most of all, it opened up a doorway for me into what I've been studying all my life, namely the mystical side of our ordinary life and the possibilities that keep opening to us of amazing new adventures and transformations, but that we turn away from. So it's an ironic story about turning away from the very things that appear to us mysteriously in our lives.
So Why do you think your book was so successful?
I don't know. I think it's got a variety of charms. You know, some people read it when they're going to go to Scotland. Other people read it as a spiritual text. Some people read it as a way to improve the mental side of performance. It's had quite an influence on a lot of players, including a lot of professionals. And it has this following among sports psychologists. Because the book came out in 72, the term the zone hadn't been coined yet.
Mm.
And I have another book called In the Zone, which is a collection of these supernormal experiences that occur through sport. Because sport does indeed, you know, have a lot of similarities to a yoga or a martial art when it's passionately pursued. Any sport does. Because it requires, I mean, if you give yourself to it, it requires a tremendous commitment of body and soul and a coordination of your mind with your performance. So in any case, a lot of people buy it as a kind of a text, a training manual for the mind and body. And other people get it just for it's fun and entertaining. So there are different reasons why people buy it.
And then you also wrote a sequel.
Yes. It came out 25 years later. The Kingdom of Shiva's Irons. The central character in the book is named Shiva's Irons. And Murphy, in the second book, goes looking again for Shiva's Irons and doesn't find him, but has another series of adventures that color and amplify his previous experiences.
Were you pushed into writing that sequel, or did it just evolve out of you? Or
well, this whole subject keeps evolving. I've written a prequel too, but it's not published. I don't think I will publish it.
Hmm.
I think it's too far out. It would be too far ahead of the curve. It's really so. It's, you know, when you give birth to something like this, to a world, it often wants to keep growing. So that second book grew out of the first book, and it describes a lot of experiences that I and other people have had that are related to the first book. For example, my meeting John Brody, who used to play quarterback for the 49ers, which did happen to me in 1972, and Brody asked me to come to the 49er training camp, and I had been a long-time season ticket holder and rabid fan of the 49ers, and he was this great quarterback, and it was an offer I couldn't refuse to go to this summer camp, and his thought was to write a book with him maybe about all of these dimensions in football, because he had experienced these things in football. And that in turn led me into world after world of sport, where this, I call it this mystical underground, exists, where people, where sports people, because of the sport, grow into these altered states of mind and, let's call them, in-the-zone type experiences, inadvertently enter into the realm where mystics and shamans want to go. But they do it, many of them, without a context, without a philosophy, without a psychology, without understanding what's going on, but in the service of the sport, either for improving their performance or their enjoyment. So that is described, that encounter with Brody is described in the second book, and 8 or 10 other such experiences. So it's a Romana Clay, that is a novel about real events, but it's fictional. the second book, as was the first book. But both of them are based on real experiences.
You talk about writing with Brody. What a great opportunity you had, especially being a 49er fan. And it's interesting that literature and sports seem to work best in not that many sports. I mean, you don't get a lot of romantic literature that involves football, but you do when it comes to baseball, boxing, and golf. And as somebody once said to me,
George Plimpton famously said, the smaller the ball, the better the literature. And he's got a point. I mean, golf arguably has the richest literature of any sport. But then baseball has a wonderful literature, not as large as golf, and then football, not as much.
Right. So why did you select golf? Was it just happened to be that way, or you knew that?
I tell you, it's a mystery to me.
Interesting. It chose you.
Norman Mailer, you know, once said that God gives every hardworking or aspiring writer one free one. Well, that was my free one.
That was your free drop.
It was my first book, not only that I wrote, but that I tried to write. And I had had the idea for some years prior, but somehow it was just there for me to do, and it was very successful.
And what is your relationship with as a golfer? I mean,
well, I don't. You know, I'm 75 now.
Okay.
You know, I was 39 when I sat down to write, and I finished the book when I was 40. It was published when I was 41, 34 years ago. I'm 75 now. I used to be a good golfer, but now I don't count my score anymore when I play. I just count how many pars or birdies I get on a round, you know. And also, I about the time I started to write, I took up running. I was in my 40s, you know, and started not only for health, but started to compete. All this seniors track and field. And I got good at it and, you know, came in third in the national championships for the 50 and over, running the, you know, I ran a 1,500 meter in 4:32 when I was 53. So I was working out all the time and loving this running. And that has persisted, and it took away my golf. And, you know, I got into the lifting weights and the whole thing. And so, I don't know, golf kind of went away.
Mm. Well, it's interesting. In the second book, or in The Kingdom of Shiva's Irons, you have a line there that you talk about the regenerative power in its plain repetitions and about practice. And it seems to me that it's not a mystery to me that you'd start running if you had a love of golf. I would think that running, swimming, and golf, that there is a monotony to it. It can be in the practice of it that you can get.
Yeah. That's very astute.
Thank you.
That's very true. In this book, this other book of mine, In the Zone, I have, you know, I attempt an analysis of what it is in sport that resembles the contemplative and shamanic and yogic traditions. And one of them is sustained, purposeful activity that requires a special sense of sacrifice. You have to really discipline yourself. And then many graces are given from this. It also requires, they both require, a lot of detachment from your ordinary stuff that comes up in you, you know, in your mind. You watch Tiger Woods. Even if he loses his temper for a moment, this extraordinary elasticity, he just comes right back. He will not quit. And what he comes back to is this incredible composure. And he's been playing all the time, all his life, since whenever Earl, his father, started him around 2 years old, and it's become his life. So that detachment from stuff that comes up in your mind, that dedication, the requirement that you develop a large number of skills. Now, let's take either golf or running. It's not that you just learn one thing, you know, a golf swing or a running stride. Those, in turn, require 8 or 10 basic components of physical activity, elasticity, balance, coordination, focus, power, etc. And each of those, in turn, trigger this flooding of the nervous system with these neuropeptides. More and more, they're understanding this. And those neuropeptides, in turn, produce these wonderful variations and elevations of mood. Among us runners, when, you know, when I started in the 70s, they had just discovered endorphin. But now, it turns out, there are 80 or 90 major classes of these neuropeptides. Endorphins is one kind, but there are all sorts of things that are produced by the variety of physical exercise. That's why, you know, that kind of glow that athletes have, you know, if they're not, you know, too ginned up with steroids and if they don't drink too much or whatever else. But, you know, the glow produced by athletics resembles the glow produced by contemplative or yogic practice. I think science is more and more understanding these amazing cocktails we mix and send straight into our bloodstream when we're exercising creatively. And it seems as if the human race is designed for creative physical activity. It's as if we're here to be bodies. And you know all of this writing of mine, because, you know, half my books are nonfiction, arise out of a philosophy of that I have that holds that the universe is evolving in the course of time to disclose more and more of its latent divinity. And we are all, in us, God is waking up, so to speak, speaking metaphorically. There's more, the human potential is far greater, it seems, than we can imagine right now. And we get glimpses of this through these sorts of activities. That, I think, actually is the real reason for the book's Golf in the Kingdom's popularity, is that it talks about this in a playful way. But it also, my nonfiction books make the case, you know, with thousands of footnotes and so forth, because there's a lot of science now turning to this human potential and to this extraordinary disclosures that come through these creative practices, whether they're, as you know, as religious as going away to some Buddhist retreat, or as mundane as playing golf with all your heart. And so,
I loved another one of your lines that you said, that golf is an exercise of imagination with hands.
Yes.
That was beautiful. And you talked just now about exercise creatively.
Yes. Well, yes. I mean, that line of mine was influenced by Coleridge, you know, the poet, who differentiated imagination, which has hands, from mere fantasies. If you imagine something very powerfully, say the way Einstein did in his famous thought experiments, out of that came the atomic bomb, you know, relativity theory, etc. So, a great poet who feels a character deeply, out comes Hamlet or Falstaff, like Shakespeare. It happens on golf courses. And, you know, those of us who are cultural snobs think, well, how can these golfers, you know, how can you compare them to Coleridge? Well, it happens. And I like to say I'm the person who really had to tell the world that golf is really a mystery school for Republicans. There they are, having these peak experiences all over the place. Even the Democrats that play, you know, the 10% are the Democrats, but they, anyway.
All right, let's take a short break. I have about 100,000 more questions to ask you. We'll take a short break. We'll come right back.
As we make the turn, we want you to know that we're taking requests. If you'd like us to feature a specific course on Golf Smarter, our email address is golfsmarter@teetour.com. That's golfsmarter, one word, at teetour.com. Whether you're planning a golf vacation, playing in an upcoming tournament, or have a favorite course for which you have a question, please let us know and we'll do a show just for you. Again, here's your host for Golf Smarter, Fred Green.
All right, we're back with Michael Murphy, the author of Golf in the Kingdom and The Kingdom of Shiva's Irons and In the Zone, among others. And we're, again, Michael, very appreciative that you give us our time to talk about this stuff. One of the things that fascinates me is there's a new generation of golfers. They're hitting the ball very far. They're not necessarily focused on the strategy of a golf course or how to read the features of a golf course. Is it a surprise to you or not that two names that are the biggest in the young studs coming up in the game are Michelle Wee and Tiger Woods, both with, Asian roots and could get more in the metaphysical part of this?
Well, that's a very, very interesting question. I wonder about them both, whether or not this, whether or not we're projecting the Buddhism onto them.
But
both of them obviously have some temperamental advantages. I haven't watched Michelle Wee play. I've seen her, you can't miss her, swinging in ads and in little short subject things. But you can look at her. Here she is. What is she, 16?
Yeah.
But Tiger I follow. The only reason these days I watch golf tournaments is if Tiger's in contention.
I'm the exact same thing.
Yeah, I somehow can't get interested unless he's in contention. But so because he's in contention so much, I have watched him a lot and definitely have a feeling for his temperament. His mother being Thai and Chinese, and I believe Buddhist, is said to have had some influence on him that way, and it's possibly true. But I've never really heard anywhere that he has any sustained meditation practice.
Well, I can't imagine that it came from his Marine's father.
More and more, as I've studied these things through the years, and this is the reason I started Esalen Institute and the reason I've written all these books, is to understand the further reaches of the human potential and this developmental process by which we can enter into a richer and richer consciousness and greater physical capacity in any field. But in sport and in other fields like this, where there is not a formal practice, it's what I'm calling these days covert practice. That is, where you are practicing to the end of your pursuit. It could be a sport, it could be a profession, it could be just in part of your life to perfect a relationship. But somehow you have dedicated yourself to this over time, and willy-nilly, it becomes a practice with a lot of resemblance to the great contemplative, yogic, religious practices. That is, you have to give up a lot of your old stuff. Principle of sacrifice, which, the root of sacrifice is to make sacred, but it means giving things up. Now, let's say in golf, giving up all these destructive thoughts when you stand up to the ball. The game has an absolute genius and perversity to bring out these awful thoughts and these violent emotions that must be contained just to hit the ball, let alone hit it straight. So that practice for equanimity, for focus, to visualize your shot, has to be developed and is if you play the game wholeheartedly. Now, with both Tiger and Michelle, apparently, this seems to be aided by this native equanimity they seem to exhibit. You know, you look at their facial features and all that. Now, it could be our projection into them, but and then they're, you have to just say that they're athletically supremely gifted, both of them, and they've had these driven parents. I mean, Earl Woods, you know, with Tiger, starting when he was two, and Michelle Wee with her parents starting when she was a child. So I don't know whether it's related to the fact of their, you know, Eastern background and their possible connections to the Buddhist world. I don't know. But it is certainly plausible. It's plausible.
Well, you know, Michelle and Tiger are great for the future of the golf business.
Amen.
You know, but
that's for sure.
But what about role models left to teach the Shivas Irons approach to the game?
Well, you know,
is that going to get lost?
Yes. Well, no, there are such, you know, Freddie Shoemaker, the wonderful teacher. He is that way.
He's a member of the Shivas Irons Society.
Yes, he is. He has his own following, his own school, his own books, Extraordinary Golf.
Extraordinary Golf and Extraordinary Putting. And we had Fred on the show just last week.
Yeah. And Glenn Albaugh, who has coached a number of top professional players like Scotty McCarron.
Now, there's great stories about you and Glenn. All, you know, you guys go way back, right?
Well, we went, you know, to grammar school together.
I sat and listened. I was the literal fly on the wall the other night at the Shivas Irons Society event where the two of you were just reminiscing about years and years and years together, and it was a joy for me.
Well, it was... He is a wonderful, wonderful human being, and anybody who is coached by Glenn is a lucky person. He has used Golf in the Kingdom as a text. So the point I want to make here is that the book has found its way into the world of golf instruction in sports psychology generally, and now, sports psychology, you know, itself has mushroomed. And, you know, different teachers operate at different levels. You have swing coaches, you know, the famous ones that we all know about, the ones that Tiger has turned to. Then you have your mainstream sports psychologists, like, say, Bob Rotella, who works with your emotions, your attitudes, your motives. And then you have a third group that are in not only into the mastery of the inner game, but the further reaches of these altered states. Let's call it the mystical side. And Glenn enters that world, and Freddie Shoemaker does. The golf instruction is co-evolving with the game itself. It's an interesting the way the game, first of all, the equipment is evolving, you know, the clubs
Absolutely.
And the balls. The instruction is evolving. The understanding of consciousness of the game is evolving, and Golf in the Kingdom has played a large catalytic role in that. And then golf course design itself is evolving. Robert Trent Jones, Jr., wrote a book,
Golf by Design.
Golf by Design, talking, for example, about illusion, the Dharma combat of the architect versus the golfer, to set up illusions that you have to see your way through, where you can't judge distance as well, and so forth. And then the design of beauty and of what they call shot value. If you play some of these beautiful courses, you come away enhanced. It's just so rich. These really are the world's largest gardens.
Oh, my gosh.
150 to 200 acres each. There are 25,000 of them now in the world, 15,000 or more in America. And the care and feeding of golf courses, it's incredible. And, you know, you talk about the great gardens of the European royalty, say at Versailles. Well, I mean, these, you know, 15,000 of them, and some of them are just unforgettable.
Absolutely.
And you play out there, and you, let's say, on a late night in June, and everything, it's starting to freshen up, and suddenly, you know, it's the air is lighter again, and there's some moisture in the air, and the sun is set, and it's what the Celts call playing in the gloaming. You're suffused with this beauty. I'll never forget this woman. She wrote to me. She said she was playing up the 18th hole of one of these great golf courses down on the Monterey Peninsula, and the sun was setting. And as she played out on the 18th, the sun set completely, but she realized that the sun was shining through the ground. And she went into the clubhouse, and it was still shining, and it shined for 3 days afterwards, and she lived in the gloaming for 3 days. Mm. Now, that is a real mystical experience by someone who had was very illiterate about mystical literature. But she wanted to ask me about this extraordinary experience. Was it caused because her retina had been stimulated by the sun? You know, there was probably her husband tried to talk her out of the experience. But in any case, isn't that an amazing thing?
It's absolutely amazing.
And I think that a large percentage of people who play golf have these kinds of experiences. Everyone, I think every golfer has some of it. And to the extent that they can absorb the experience, then it stays with them. It resonates afterwards. It's a very sensuous game. You know, a lot of people think of golf as not a sensuous game, but it is extremely sensuous because you have to make these swings, you know, which release all these neuropeptides, some of which are called opioid peptides, into your bloodstream. You get high on this. Now, it can be interfered with by all the cursing and failed shots and shanks and, you know, all
the frustration.
The frustration, all the flotsam and jetsam of your golfing unconscious can float up to the surface, you know. So, but to the extent that you can get past all that and play the game with this equanimity, then you can experience the sensuous side. And that woman's description, imagine that. The sun had gone down, but now the sun was shining through the ground.
Mm.
And in the clubhouse afterward, it was shining, and it was shining 3 days later.
Wow.
And she was in a state. And so reading Golf in the Kingdom gave her a context for this, because Golf in the Kingdom is about these kinds of states, you know. When the book first came out in 72, a man named Jim Benepy, his son actually was on the tour. I think he's the father of the same younger Jim Benepy. But in any case, I had met this older Jim Benepy, and he said, Mike, true gravity, Shiva's Irons, the protagonist of the book, talks about true gravity. He says, is this what it is? He said, I was playing the 18th hole on a course I loved, a long uphill five par, and somehow your book got me into a state, and I was shooting the best score I had ever shot on this course. And I came to the 18th hole, and for the first time in my life, I hit it in two shots. And he said, as I was walking up this long uphill fairway, I suddenly felt as if I was walking downhill. And it was such an intense experience that I suddenly remembered your thing about true gravity. Is this what true gravity meant? Well, that was the first report I ever got from somebody about that phenomenon. Since, I've gotten dozens of reports of this reversal of gravity. I could go on and on about the different kinds of altered states that people get into, but that's, again, the kind of thing that can get triggered by this crazy game.
It seems that golf has more participants as they grow older and mature. Do you think that has some impact on the fact that as we get older and as we get wiser and we surrender to the forces that are out of our control? Because, you know, when you're young and you're playing those kind of sports that require much more physicality,
right?
You don't really have time to think about it, where on a golf course you do. And, again, you're maturing.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. I don't know the percentages now of the different age groups that play the game, but it certainly as you get older and there's less adrenaline and less testosterone, as we produce less of the fight and flight response, mm-hmm. and more of and learn to get a little more control of our sympathetic and parasympathetic nervous systems, and parasympathetic the one to relax us. I think you're right that you're capable of a deeper, more sensuous, lasting enjoyment. In that way, it resembles sexual activity. Young guys, bam, bam, thank you, ma'am, when you're in your late teens. But as you get older, if you still enjoy sex, there can be this, that it's more time for dilation and, openness. I think all life can be that way if you stay healthy and if you enter into life fully, that it becomes deeper and richer and more sensuous and more open, and it can be. And that's one of the great promises of all the contemplative practices and yogic practices and of sport. And, of course, golf you can play all your life, too. I mean, you can, you can't and shouldn't play football all your life.
Or even basketball.
Yeah, the arthritis and the
right.
muscle pulls and, each body can only do so many, jumps and hop, skip, and jump, But golf you can play into your, all your life.
And maybe because it's a participatory sport that you can go through for most of your life, bowling too, but there's not enough time to contemplate anything in bowling. There's just so much activity everywhere and so much noise.
Yeah.
But I think this is what separates golf from other sports, is the fact that you can play it your whole life.
Right. I mean, there are a number of things. Golf, I had no idea golf had as many of these dimensions as it does. When I wrote that book, I had played golf. I started, relatively late, I think, to be a good player, but I started at 14, and in 2 years I got it down to a 4 handicap and played Kenny Venturi in the finals of the Northern California Junior Championship, the President's Flight. That is, if everybody... I was only 16, he was only 15. Anyway, I got good fast. I have a feeling for it over a lifetime, the game. And having taken up running in middle age, these other sports are limited for a lifetime, and golf is great that way.
Well, golf also has a social aspect to it. What do you think it is about golf that lends itself to not only conversation but the deepening of friendships?
Yes, it does. You're absolutely right, and. Golf writers have been celebrating that since the 18th century. Tom Watson said, after 5 holes of golf with someone, practically everything you want to know or should know about someone.
and you can learn a lot about how somebody conducts business by watching them on a golf course.
Amen. Amen. We do reveal ourselves in golf. I had somebody in Golf in the Kingdom say, nowhere does a man go so naked as he does all dressed for golf.
Why do we love to watch a ball in flight? What is it about that little white ball that we just love to get up in the air and stare at it? Whether you're watching your own or you're watching it on TV, it's just
Well, I had a lot of fun.
Magical.
I call, the second half of Golf in the Kingdom, I sometimes called Gonzo metaphysics, after Hunter Thompson's Gonzo, but I had fun with it. These archetypes that get traced, like filigrees of light against the sky, you know, in the flight of the ball, and how this could remind us of deep dimensions of the way we're built, and how it could relate to, you know, the fact that we love to throw things, and how, you know, if we hadn't thrown things, the Homo sapiens sapiens wouldn't have evolved, because that gave us an advantage over so many of the animals we had to combat with or hunted, whether these were rocks or spears or whatever. And throwing things. We love baseball. We love football. We love the forward pass in football. We love these balls headed out. So part of it are our hunting past. There's something in our destiny, you know, that's outward bound. And golf is a little mini version of it. It opens up our secret imagination to these possibilities. That's, you know, one reason we love these long towering drives, you know, and or being able to shape a shot, you know, to fade it or to draw it. So you paint these filigrees against the sky. It's amazing.
It really is. You know, there are books that don't lend themselves to the silver screen, to the big screen, but they end up there anyway. They shouldn't have been in the first place.
Yeah.
But I think Golf in the Kingdom is so visual in so many ways.
Well, you know, it's been 34 years. There's somebody been making a movie about this thing for all 34 years.
Oh, is that right?
I've sold 17 options. Warner Brothers owned it for 10 years for Clint Eastwood. No one's figured out how to make it.
Wow.
So at times I wonder whether Clint Eastwood couldn't figure out how it can be done. Sean Connery, who loved the book, I played golf with him once, and he was feeling at that time it just couldn't be done. It's too special a book.
Hmm.
Although he thought, you know, to give it a try. No one's done it, and maybe it can't be done. I don't know.
So who would you want to play Michael Murphy in the movie?
No one I've met. I wouldn't want to wish that on anyone.
But who would you want to play? Now, you say Sean Connery. Would he be a great Shivas Irons?
Well, of course. He'd be great at anything he wanted to do. But I don't know. We asked Daniel Day-Lewis to do it, and he said no. I could see him doing it.
Sure.
I think he could pull it off, the Shivas Irons character. He's the best I've seen who fits for me, someone who could morph into that Shivas Irons character, Daniel Day-Lewis. But he said, he's Irish ancestry, lives in England, but he said his distaste for golf equals that the distaste of his friends for the Catholic Church. Anyway, that's what he said.
Well, hopefully someday we'll get to see something, or just keep it in our minds and play it over in our minds.
Well, I like to say, you know, Golf in the Kingdom is perhaps the longest running virtual movie, coming soon to a mind near yours. So, anyway. Thanks for all of this.
Thank you, Michael. And again, the book is Golf in the Kingdom, The Kingdom of Shivas Irons, and In the Zone, Michael Murphy. If I can speak for everybody, thank you for providing us with this kind of literature that really helps life and our game.
Well, thanks. This has been a great conversation. Thanks a million.
Thanks so much, Michael.
Okay.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that, because that was a lot of fun for me. Last week's interview with Fred Shoemaker, a disciple of Michael Murphy's, has offered to give away 4 signed copies of his books, Extraordinary Golf and Extraordinary Putting. Now, the winners will be announced on August 8th, so you still have time before we do the random drawing of the winners' names. To enter, send us an email to golfsmarter@teetour.com. TEETOUR.com with your name and your snail mail address so that we can send you the book if you're the winner. Now, if you would like to win Extraordinary Golf, put Extraordinary Golf in the subject of your email. If you want to win the book Extraordinary Putting, then put extraordinary putting in the subject line. And some people have sent emails to both, and that's just fine. Give yourself a chance to win both books or at least one of them. And if you want full information, of course, check the show notes. Don't forget to check out BunkerShot.com, the online golf magazine, for news, articles, and more. And hopefully you've been telling your golf buddies about the Golf Smarter podcast. And now there's a way for you to tell the world with our Golf Smarter postage stamps. They come in sheets of 20 and can be picked up at Zazzle.com, Zazzle.com/Fred Greene, Greene. A lot of spelling going on here. Let everyone know you're a golfer, and even better, let them know that you golf smarter. Now we end with our quote of the week submitted by you. If you have a favorite golf quote, send an email with the subject golf quote to golfsmarter@ttour.com. And this week's quote was sent by Christina Parsons of Shreveport, Louisiana, who offers a quote that keeps you in the present and helps you avoid a triple when you're on your way to a record low score. And the quote is, four words that should never be said on the golf course. If I could just... Christina, I'll offer you six words that will keep your scores down. If I would just golf smarter. Thanks for listening. I'm Fred Greene.